Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. For years, American conservatives have used the word liberal as a taunt, an epithet, an insult. Now, after 8 years of George Bush and economic collapse, conservatism is licking its wounds. And liberalism, says my guest today, is back, big time. And he says, just in time. But what does it mean now in the Obama era? This hour on Point, are we getting liberal again? You can join the conversation. Are you ready for a dose of liberalism? Do you hear it in President Obama? And what does it mean to you today? Joining me now in the studio is Alan Wolfe, professor of political science and director of the Boise Center for Religion and American Public Life at Boston College. He's author of the new book, The Future of Liberalism. Alan, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you, Tom.
So are we liberal again, or as you might have it, have we always been in spite of how it seemed?
Well, I think we've always been to a significant degree. I think the conservative years are the great exception. This country was thought of as the great liberal country at the time that it had its revolution, that it separated church and state, that it adopted Thomas Jefferson's rhetoric in the Declaration of Independence, when it put into practice the ideas of John Locke, one of the great liberal thinkers of earlier times. It's always been known as a liberal country. The conservative years were really, really odd. And even during the conservative years, the Ronald Reagan years, for example, some of the ideas of liberalism were adopted, especially in his second term when he sought a more peaceful world.
Of course, there were plenty of conservative politicians voted in during what you call those odd years. Now President Obama has been voted in. When you watch him, when you look at his policy, when you listen to him, do you see a new liberal president at the helm?
Oh, absolutely. I wrote my book because I sensed that liberalism was making a comeback. I didn't really expect, I would love it if conservatives were persuaded by my arguments in favor of liberalism, but you know, we had 8 years of George Bush and Dick Cheney. If they can't persuade conservatives to become liberals, I can't. They pretty much destroyed conservatism. I'll add Rush Limbaugh to that list. Now, I wrote my book to make liberals, to remind liberals of what the liberal tradition is. All too often, liberals adopt terms like progressive, a term I have a lot of problems with, or they, when they become president, like Bill Clinton, they seek what Bill Clinton called triangulation. We have a great liberal moment at the present time, and so far so good for Obama. He seems to be taking advantage of it.
I don't hear him using the word liberal.
I don't hear him using the word liberal either, but he has developed a budget that has extraordinary ambition to resurrect the liberal agenda for the United States. He's certainly taken steps with respect to the closing of Guantanamo to bring the United States back to its liberal traditions. Frankly, Tom, I wish he did use the word liberal. I think the president is in a unique position to remind us of our heritage and to remind us what's good about it. On the other hand, I actually sense that Obama is liberal plus. That is, he really wants to fundamentally realign the country. And one way to do that is to pursue an aggressive liberal agenda without calling yourself liberal.
Let's go back to first principles. The title of your book is The Future of Liberalism, but you spend a lot of time looking at kind of the basics here. What are the pillars? It's been sort of pilloried, pillar to post for such a long time. I think a lot of that's been driven off stage, and people did end up a very liberal era with some serious misgivings about some of the outcomes of liberalism, and we saw that for years again at the polls. But when you look back to first principles, what do you point to, Alan?
Well, it is true. This book does try to go back to first principles. A lot of the book deals with the ideas of the great liberal thinkers. I mentioned John Locke, John Stuart Mill, Immanuel Kant, in the United States, John Dewey, and I have a whole host of others. Mm-hmm. Because one of my really fundamental convictions is that there has been a consistent liberal outlook on the world for a couple of hundred years. I define liberalism as the idea that as many people as possible should have as much control over the course of their lives as feasible. In other words, it's the idea of autonomy, the idea that we're in charge of what we do, that it's not God and it's not nature that determines for us how we ought to live, but we ourselves. That's a fundamental liberal conviction. But you can't have that. This is what conservatives don't understand, unless everybody has that, unless the idea of autonomy is linked to the idea of equality, because I can't lead an autonomous life if other people can't. I can't lead a life free of crime if poverty breeds crime. I can't lead a life in which I'm in charge of my major decisions about my health if other people carry infectious diseases. Liberty or equality. Liberty, autonomy, equality, these are what liberalism has always been about.
Anthony Appiah read your book and said what you've come away with here is seven habits of truly liberal people. I mean, he's having fun with you in a way, but at the same time, but you do point to dispositions of the liberally oriented mind, and I think you've got seven. What are they?
Right. Well, I loved Appiah's review. It was the kind of review everybody wants. He's a very, very distinguished philosopher and a sharp critic, mm-hmm. and the fact that he liked my book was great. I think that we need to capture the meaning of liberalism what I call liberalism in full, that it's not just about what economic policy you pursue. It's not just about how you feel on a particular piece of legislation. That liberalism is in many ways a state of mind. I call them dispositions or predispositions. For example, one of the most important is that liberals don't take people as they are, but think about people as they could be, or as they, if they were to truly and fully develop their capacities, will be. This is fundamental. Conservatives often like to say, well, you know, people buy certain things, and that really indicates that that's what people want. But for liberals, the question of our wants and our needs are not what we do out of desperation. They're not out of what we do when we don't have any choices. They're what we do when we fully realize our capacity as human beings. So that's one of the, you know, fundamental liberal dispositions that I talk about. You don't want me to go through and name
give us some others. I mean, this one's absolutely fundamental and fundamentally important because you believe in that capacity for humans to kind of take charge of their circumstances, even maybe their nature, and change it.
No, that's absolutely correct.
Conservatives very skeptical.
Well, conservatives, I mean, I'm very struck by, you know, as I think any author is, by the enormous popularity of Rick Warren, the preacher, his book, The Purpose-Driven Life.
Mm-hmm.
I try to argue in this book that liberals believe in a purpose-driven life. In fact, a life without purpose has no meaning whatsoever. The question is, who determines your purpose? In the past, in the 18th and 19th century, liberals fought a war, an ideological war, with conservative religious believers who said God determines our purpose for us. Liberals have won that war. I think almost all of us now choose to live the kind of life we want to lead. But now liberals face a new problem. Those who argue that our genes determine everything we're going to be, those who say that we're the product of evolutionary forces that make the choices for us. We make our own choices. In other words, we live for purpose. Liberalism is not some neutral thing that says one choice is as good as any other. That's not what it's about. We live for purpose, but the purposes are ours to construct. That is absolutely fundamental.
You say there's a disposition to grow, a sympathy for equality, a preference for realism, an inclination to deliberate, a commitment to tolerance, an appreciation of openness, and, as very clear in Barack Obama's budget, a taste for governance.
That's right. I mean, we could talk about any of them. I think one of the most interesting, from my point of view, is this idea about realism, because this is something that I think is frequently misunderstood. I try to show in the book how liberalism emerged. Liberalism was first used as a political idea. It's always been an adjective that means generous or warm or capacious. Mm. But it was used in a political sense for the first time during the Napoleonic Wars, when the Spanish were the first people to have a liberal party. And it called for removal of Napoleon from the Iberian Peninsula. Competing with liberalism at the very same time during the Napoleonic Wars was the notion of Romanticism. This was when the great Romantic poets were writing. And they loved glory. They loved causes. They, in fact, loved war. There was a tendency to imagine a perfect world and to strive through the ecstatic imagination to bring it into being. That's not what liberalism is about. Liberalism is about being realistic. It's about being hard-headed. It's about respecting and taking the world as a given and trying to direct it to our own purposes rather than to transcend it through some kind of romantic sensibility. So I have a lot of fun in that chapter with romanticism. One of my basic arguments is that when we look at the neocons today, the Bill Kristols and the Charles Krauthammers who argued for war in Iraq, they were actually romantics. I don't think the term neoconservative really, there's nothing conservative about them. They're romantics who wanted to transform the world. Let's bring a whole new era into being today, tomorrow, in Iraq. That's a terrible sensibility that liberals have to be skeptical of.
Though there's another vein of realism among conservatives that would say, well, the problem with liberals is they love government and are so believing in its potential that they let it overwhelm human potential, individual potential. You know that language conservatives would describe as realistic.
That's right. No, I would respond as I do in the book by saying that if you're committed to reality, to dealing with reality, government is an inescapable fact of modern life. Look, we had Reagan, we had Bush. They couldn't do anything about government. It grew under them. We need government. This is what is so exciting about Obama. He may not be making the case for liberalism yet, but he's making the case for government. We need government to live. The question is, do we pretend like in the romantic spirit that conservatives do that we can just simply eliminate it? Well, down that path is chaos.
But are you pretending there's no downside to government?
No. In fact, I talk in the book about what I call the curse of the state, that government imposes a curse upon every political philosophy. There's no perfect political philosophy. Liberalism, though, says, look, we recognize that there are problems. Again, let's try to deal with them rather than pretending they don't exist.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about liberalism on a comeback in the Obama era and what that means. My guest is political scientist Alan Wolf of Boston College. His new book is The Future of Liberalism, and he's looking at what's out there in front of us right now. Let's get a couple of famously liberal voices in our ear. Here's FDR, inaugural address, 1933. The Great Depression required a new way of doing business, he said. It was the beginnings of the New Deal.
Our greatest primary task is to put people to work. This is no unsolvable problem if we face it wisely and courageously. It can be accomplished in part by direct recruiting by the government itself, treating the task as we would treat the emergency of a war, but at the same time, through this employment, accomplishing greatly needed projects to stimulate and reorganize.
Government can do it, said FDR. Then here's LBJ, Great Society President, May 1964 in Michigan, a soaring vision of a better America. He said it meant ending poverty and racism, but that is just the beginning, he said.
The Great Society is not a safe harbor, a resting place, a final objective, a finished work. It is a challenge constantly renewed, beckoning us toward a destiny where the meaning of our lives matches the marvelous products of our labor.
The Great Society, no resting place, no indeed. Then came Richard Nixon, and then came Ronald Reagan in a very different perspective. Now Barack Obama is in, conservatives looking at that. Here's Rush Limbaugh at the Conservative Political Action Conference in Washington last week, saying conservatives need to get people to focus on President Obama's beliefs, not the man himself. His policies can be described in a word, he said.
I got over the historical aspects of this in November. President Obama is our president. President Obama stands for certain things. I don't care. He could be a Martian. He could be from Michigan. I don't like it. Doesn't matter to me what his race is. It doesn't matter. He's liberal is what matters to me. And his articulated plans scare me.
He's liberal, says Rush Limbaugh. And that is the taunt that has worked for a long, long time. Does it still? Alan Wolf is with us. His new book is The Future of Liberalism. Let's get a call from Augusta, Georgia. And Ron, you're on the air.
Yeah, thanks, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. You know, you actually highlighted it while I was waiting. I think that there is no liberal basis anymore. It's been too many generations. People think that liberalism is a government handout. And if you look at the problems with the economy and with the financial bailout, it's the same thing. There's a society basis of greed now. What is in it for me? Not looking at a societal, you know, growth and development, which is really what true liberalism is. So I think that the 30 years or so or longer since it was a true liberal agenda, I think people have lost that. I don't think they know how to deal with it.
Alan Wolf, what do you say?
Well, first, Tom, I have to congratulate you for putting LBJ, FDR, and RL, Rush Limbaugh, together in that little pastiche.
It's the world we live in.
You know, you've perfectly illustrated my point, and as does, I think, the caller's important question. I mean, what I got out of those speeches, and I reread, you know, all those speeches in doing this book, is that there will be liberalism so long as human beings have ambitions. That liberalism is an ambitious ideal, and that really comes out in the FDR and the LBJ thing. Now, it's because ambitions always involve risks that I think we have conservatism. Conservatism is at its best at warning us against risk, because there'll always be risks when you try to do great things. But does that mean that we never try to do great things? Does that mean that we incorporate the risks from the very, very start and say, look, we know we're going to fail, therefore we're not even going to try? Well, that kind of thing doesn't work. And it especially doesn't work in a time of crisis like the one we're in now. We have to take risks, which means that we have to be liberal at this moment.
But you know, and Ron refers to this, that for many years, the sort of consensus conclusion, and with many people dissenting, nevertheless, in this country was too much liberalism. It is the government handout critique that Ron raises. It undercuts motivation, creates dependency, reduces risk-taking by individuals that cumulatively, for a long time now, has been the view of many Americans, pushed the country, a society, ahead. Is that not still active? Is that debunked by the mess we're in now?
Oh, it's absolutely debunked. First of all, you had George W. Bush expanding the deficits and expanding government handouts to every major lobbyist and interest group that wanted one. After that, where can you possibly argue that instead of doing that, we should be using the government and its powers to help many people rather than to just help the select few? I hope we have later on a conservative who can explain to me why the conservative criticism of handouts can be seriously entertained these days after the 8 years of Bush. Bush really changed the landscape in many ways. In his own backward way, he opened the door for an Obama by using government the way he did. Once he used government for the few, why not use it for the many?
Of course, you'll have critics who say, well, fine, but if you get government that deeply involved, you're not going to have the kind of growth, economic growth rates that the U.S. has seen. Of course, we see where we are now. They'll point to Europe and say Europe has more social welfare and they've had lower growth over, and then they're also in trouble now.
Well, that's an economist's argument, and I know economists can show that actually government spending does increase economic growth, but that's not my point. You know, my point is not government per se. My point is that government is a symbol of our collective capacity, that government is us, that government represents what we want to do that we cannot do by our own individual efforts. And so long as we as a people, we as Americans believe that we have a destiny, government is the instrument of that destiny, and we are far better off using it and shaping it to our purposes. When we criticize government the way conservatives so often do, we're criticizing the idea that we can get anything done at all. And I think Americans are much too adventurous and much too, in fact, entrepreneurial of people to accept that kind of defeatism right from the start.
Let's get a call from Fort Myers, Florida, and John. Hi, John. You're on the air with Alan Wolf.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Alan. I appreciate you taking my call. A couple of the main issue that I wanted to talk about was I think it was John Dean that pointed out in his book that the greatest promise and the first liberal promise in the United States was, of course, in the Declaration of Independence, where Jefferson wrote, you know, all men are created equal. into each other, in society, and in the eyes of God. And that was the basis for what was coming later on. All the great decisions, all the great things that really were undertaken in the United States, including finally the abolition of slavery all the way through the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Act, the concept of a five-day work week, the concept of a labor unions and stopping child labor, the idea of Social Security, the idea of Medicare. These are all things that conservatives tried to stop, and fortunately were unsuccessful. If you try to get a laundry list out of great things that America has done in the last 200 years, you're going to find very few things that were supported by conservatives. It was liberal minds who created those.
John, let us take that and hold the thought for just a moment and get another call right behind you here, if I may. From Williamsburg, Virginia, we've got Martin on the air. Hi, Martin.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I'm listening to this. I think that there is the salient point is what is the difference between the liberalism he's talking about and socialism or communism that has never really fed anybody, cleaned up the environment, or done anything unless it was practiced in a very small country with an indigenous related family type nationality, or unless it was supported by some great natural resources that free capitalist countries and people who embraced true free markets and principles had the money to buy from some dictator who confiscated it and then used the proceeds to support his failed principles and economic policies.
Martin, I hear you loud and clear, and I will put the question to Alan Wolf. Let me just ask you before I do, what do you make of the circumstances the country is in now after these decades of Reagan conservatism having been dominant? Do you see it as a failure of conservatism or not?
Well, there's no question this is a triumph of what we're calling collectivism or socialism, but I would like to say that every one of these swings, as things get to their extreme, there's always been this up and down. And as we get to an extreme of one set of philosophies, then the abuses sneak in, the immorality, the personal selfishness, whether it's the rich or the poor that are abusing the other side. These are the things that justify the anger and resentment in the human psychology that leads to this. And that's the balancing mechanism of democracy. But no democracy can be any better than the people who make up that democracy. If you have an immoral population that believes in abortion and abuse of others, it doesn't matter whether they're rich or poor, it's going to go downhill. That's my point.
Martin, let us pick it up. Alan Wolf, you know that this word, socialism, is being quickly sort of subbed in for liberalism as the critique, and Martin appears to embrace it. So what's the difference? What's the difference if you go with this perspective?
Well, I think the two previous calls illustrate one of the themes of my book almost perfectly. The first caller, I believe his name was John, says, you know, when we look back in the past, the things that we're most proud of, that we take the greatest pride in, were done under liberals. And we very rarely look back on the conservatives, you know, the Calvin Coolidges, who were president of the United States, and find anything to honor. But the second caller said, no, this is all socialism. Well, the way I would put it is that because liberalism has, in fact, been responsible for so many great things, critics of liberalism don't want to call it by its own name, and they substitute the term socialism instead. Liberalism has been the most powerful antidote to socialism in the modern world. Liberals believe in the idea of autonomy, as I said, and they believe in the idea that individual autonomy is achieved through our collective efforts. Socialist governments, to the degree that they suppress individual autonomy, are anti-liberal. Now, of course, it all depends on what we're talking about here. If we're talking about communism, communism is one of the most powerful anti-liberal forces in the modern world, and liberals took much more seriously in American history the struggle against communism than conservatives, who were often isolationists and didn't want to confront communism. If we're talking about countries like Canada or Sweden, those are liberal countries. Those are liberal countries that use government in a democratic way to further collective objectives. They probably go further than the United States ever will. But condemning them as socialist just doesn't get us very far. It's a misuse of proper terminology.
Martin raised another of the critiques very firmly put against liberalism that perhaps in its emphasis on autonomy, it overlooks morality. It leads to an immoral population, his phrase.
I view my book as an effort to reject that whole line of argument. Mm-hmm. Liberalism, to me, is a moral philosophy. Autonomy is a moral goal. We, all of us, seek, I think, to have an autonomous life. People who face very difficult decisions involving life or death issues, people who face some of the most fundamental moral dilemmas, whether they're religious or not, whether they call themselves conservative or not, want this principle of autonomy. It is a great moral ideal. Now, it's also true that we have a tremendous amount of things like pornography and crime and mm-hmm. sexual violence in the United States. Invariably, alas, those tend to happen in states that call themselves conservatives much more than they call themselves liberal. But I'm not going to get into a jousting match at this point. I just want to say that what we deal with when we deal with an argument between a liberal and conservative is not an argument between immorality and morality, but between one version of morality and another. And the liberal version of morality is a very powerful, very compelling, and very attractive one.
Are you quite certain that Barack Obama is your style of liberal? I mean, it is a big word. Is he the Alan Wolf variety? Many are speculating, well, maybe he's a more centrist liberal. He wants, you know, we're kind of in a new wave of liberalism where, yes, autonomy, collective effort, government, but also to keep the power, the motivating power of the market alive. Does that line up with your notion of a good liberal?
By and large, it does, although I have to point out that I wrote this book before the election of 2008 was mm-hmm. decided, and I didn't want to write a book about the Obama administration. I wanted to write a book that would remind us of liberalism's long past and project liberalism into the future. There will be other presidents besides Barack Obama, and I hope they'll be liberal ones. Look, you know, so far so good as far as I'm concerned with Barack Obama. I'm delighted. You know, I have my criticism here and there, but I'm delighted with what he's doing. But, you know, the really important question is not about who's president. It's about which ideas are powerful and attractive and resonate in America. I believe that liberalism has been so long identified with America that Americans need to remember that, and they need to get it back. And if they do, that will transcend the Obama years.
And the words that you would put in people's mind in place of government handout when they hear liberal?
Sense of purpose decided by ourselves collectively using the best means available. Look, Tom, we're in the middle of a terrible recession. Mm-hmm. Do we sit back and say, oh, these things are inevitable? Business cycles happen. Mm-hmm. Too bad for the people. That's the way people used to talk. You know, too bad. It'll work itself out. No, we say we must bring it under control. We have the intelligence, we have the capacity, and we have the means. I'm glad we have the intelligence. I'm glad we have the capacity. The means are called government, and that's why we use it.
We're going to hear from a conservative voice when we come back. What's your confidence level? I mean, it's a huge experiment, Barack Obama putting out these trillions in this budget. It will work or it won't at some point. I mean, do you feel liberalism on trial or as coming to the rescue in the Obama
I feel that we have no choice but to be ambitious at this moment, and that if the American people live up to the potential they have, it will succeed.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about liberalism on a comeback in the Obama era and what that means. My guest is Alan Wolf. He's author of the new book, The Future of Liberalism. Looks a lot at its past as well and its roots. He says it's back. He welcomes it back. We'll hear in just a moment from conservative Byron York, but let's hear from the president just for a second first. In his weekly radio address this weekend, President Obama said he recognizes that his proposed budget represents dramatic change. He didn't say liberal, but he said sweeping change.
I know these steps won't sit well with the special interests and lobbyists who are invested in the old ways of doing business. And I know they're gearing up for a fight as we speak. My message to them is this: so am I. The system we have now might work for the powerful and well-connected interests that have run Washington for far too long, but I don't. I work for the American people. I didn't come here to do the same thing we've been doing or take small steps forward. I came to provide the sweeping change that this country demanded when it went to the polls in November.
President Obama, in his weekly radio address, "They're spoiling for a fight, so am I," said the president. Alan Wolf's new book is The Future of Liberalism. He joins me in the studio this hour. With us right now from Washington, D.C. is Byron York, longtime writer for the National Review, now chief political correspondent for the Washington Examiner, author of The Vast Left-Wing Conspiracy. Byron York, thanks very much for being here.
Hi, Tom. Good to be here.
So are we a liberal nation again, Byron?
Well, I would have to think that liberals have reason to be very, very happy now. I mean, they have a president in the White House who was elected by not a huge, but a solid majority. They have a liberal Speaker of the House with 256 Democrats in the House, a liberal Senate Majority Leader with 58, maybe 59 senators in the Senate. So these are very, very good times for them.
Alan Wolf says we are essentially a liberal country, that the conservative decades were just coming out of, perhaps, were an aberration. How do you see that, Byron?
You know, obviously some of the great achievements of American history have been the work of liberal presidents. We won World War II under one, for example. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think what we're going to see in the future, in the next few years, is that liberal ideals will get scuffed up by their contact with the political process and political reality, just as some conservative ideas did in the last several years. So that I was reading, I admit that I haven't read Alan Wolf's book yet, but for example,
I recommend it to you, Byron.
Thank you very much. He talks about a preference for realism being part of the liberal temperament, something that really came from the Bush years. You saw a lot of references to the reality-based community.
Sneering references from some in the Bush camp.
And I think that what you'll see is, you know, for example, you know, do the Obama administration's projections for economic growth in the next few years, which is the absolute foundation of all of his plans, are they realistic? Well, I would argue that they're not, and what has happened is his ideals have come into contact with the responsibility of governing, and, you know, things get messier then.
Our caller from Virginia was saying there's a pendulum swing in American politics. We go right, we go left. We go liberal, we go conservative. As a conservative, looking at the economy, looking at the state of the nation right now, do you think it's time for a dose of liberalism, Byron?
Well, look, Bush messed up terribly. I went down and I was asked to address the Republican Governors Association in Miami a few days after the presidential election, and I was thinking, what can I say? And you know, there was this enormous amount of Republican sort of navel-gazing going on at this time, and where have we gone wrong? Have we abandoned our true principles? And I decided to just say, well, you know, there's a couple of things that you really shouldn't do. You had a candidate who a lot of the Republican base didn't like. And you had a president you were trying to succeed who was in the 20s who had started a war essentially by mistake, that is, on premises that turned out to be not accurate. So, I mean, look, the public punishes you at the polls for that, and that's what's happened.
Alan Wolf, clear as that, and now it's time. The pendulum swings. It's liberalism's day, no doubt about it. Or are you waiting, like Byron York, to see if President Obama's numbers prove that he's got a reality-based presidency going on?
Oh, I think Byron York is absolutely right. I think that there will be a confrontation with reality, just as he describes, that the liberal vision that Obama has put forward is a very ambitious one. It's meant to be ambitious, and it will be scuffed up, I think, was Byron's term, and I'm sure it will be. I think that this is a great opportunity, this liberal moment for conservatives. Conservatism, as Byron York says, you know, has had some problems during the Bush years. I say in my book that a country in which there were only liberals would not be a liberal country, that liberalism is, among other things, a capacity and willingness to deliberate, and you've got to deliberate with someone. I really hope that these years, the Obama years and beyond, will be great years for conservative thinking. I think liberals need strong conservatives to be good liberals. We haven't had that recently. You know, the Republican Party has become the party of Joe the Plumber or this Rick Santelli or whatever his name is. Some very prominent conservatives like John Derbyshire have been criticizing this kind of populism. It's not at the moment a conservatism of ideas, and I think that's a terrible shame. And I'm looking forward to people like Byron York to contribute to the revival of a deep and philosophical conservatism in the future years.
Byron, do you see Americans holding up a banner of liberal proudly again? Do you see it out there in the country? Is the vote for Barack Obama evidence of that? We saw at the Conservative Political Action Committee in Washington last week, still plenty of conservatives ready to wave the conservative flag in spite of all the mess around us.
Well, yes. I mean, look, conservatives, a lot of conservatives believe that their values were actually betrayed or lost by Republicans in Congress and by George W. Bush. So they see the problem not with conservatism, but with the politicians who practiced it badly. And you have to remember, Republicans were, what should I say, laughing, not laughing. They were, some of them were quite contemptuous toward the whole idea of compassionate conservatism, which Bush had used to sell himself in the year 2000. As far as Obama is concerned, I don't really view his election as a great liberal mandate because the other party was exhausted and had messed up so much. There was a long period in the campaign in which voters were trying to figure out whether it was safe enough to elect him, not just because of his inexperience, but because of just sort of changing the whole direction. They reached that point, and then there was an economic collapse, which kind of nailed the coffin shut, and it was all done. But I don't think it was a big liberal revolution, although that is the result. I mean, that's what we have in terms of the power structure in Washington.
Alan Wolf, how about it? Are we in the midst of a liberal revolution?
Yeah, I would slightly disagree. I do think people were searching for something for a long time during the campaign. But the truth of the matter is that the Republican Party, the McCain-Palin ticket, simply had no ideas. They had no ideas whatsoever, and they spent a campaign attacking the Democrats. And that's what didn't resonate. People really wanted to hear ideas in this election. To me, the most interesting thing is that the only ideas out there during the campaign were liberal ideas. And that, I think, is what puts us back on the path where, you know, when we have these moments where we want to do something, where we want to take steps, we look to liberals because conservatives haven't offered them. I hope they do.
But you write in the summation of your book, after all this long history, you say, now, at this moment in history, the biggest challenge, quoting here, the biggest challenge is to get liberals to once again believe in liberalism. If the country's so primed for its comeback, if it is back in Barack Obama, if it's so effective and important, liberals still don't believe in it?
Well, first, I give a great deal of credit to Republicans and conservatives as campaigners. They did a terrific job attacking liberalism and with great success in the country. Governing, of course, they've had terrible problems. But as perpetual campaigners and as critics, they've been terrific critics of liberalism, and they've certainly had an impact. But reality has set in, and, you know, I think liberals in America will be, the word liberalism itself will come back into favor, because you really ought to call something by what it is, and that's what we're dealing with. We're not dealing with progressivism. We're in a liberal moment, not a progressive one.
Let's get a call from Newport, Rhode Island, and Matt. Matt, you're on the air.
Yes. Thank you for taking my call, first of all, and it's an honor to speak with Mr. Wolf there and Tom yourself. Got a couple things. First of all, I'd like to agree with you on a couple things, and then maybe ask for some clarification.
Okay.
But first of all, there's you've been using terms, you know, progressive, liberal, conservative, and then going back to individual accomplishments. The problem, there's a fallacy there, and the fallacy is that many things that we look back on through the highlight of, you know, the 2020 hindsight, the things that we might look at as liberal or conservative really are the context of their times. You have to look at them in the context of the times and what was going on there. And so it's somewhat of a fallacy to extrapolate too much from that.
Well, on the other hand, FDR, you know, took up the torch against fascism, put the whole country to work in that effort, and the U.S. won the war. I mean, he was a pretty liberal president, you'd have to say.
Right. Well, the problem once again, though, is there's another fallacy in there, and and your guest there, Mr. Wolf, I'm sure is more is better versed in this than I am, and that's the question of, do the ends justify the means? One thing that is often has been repeated here is that there were quote liberal leaders that accomplished great things. Most specifically, if you look back, there were some great accomplishments. Expansion of the country. We're under what we would look at now as typically liberal leaders. However, there were horrible things that happened along with that.
Fair enough. Matt, that's fair enough. How about now? Do you see Barack Obama as a liberal president? Do you welcome that at this point in our history?
I would say that he is a liberal, and as I told the screener there, I personally, and this is the main point here, I would consider myself personally liberal, but the problem is that when you, as your other guest there pointed out to the interaction with reality and the execution using the political arena, the problem is that politicians have many other things that they have to consider. So when it comes time to executing a consistent philosophy, they oftentimes run into trouble with that whole reality thing. One of the realities is that absolute power, I mean, you heard this before, and take your thoughts on it, and what are some ways the current administration can guard against it, but absolute power corrupts absolutely on a personal level, on a corporate level, on a governmental level. And another thing that you've also mentioned, I'm trying to remember this here, is that you're saying, you know, things like the your version, your idea of liberalism is that it's a, you know, for personal autonomy. But if that's the case, and this is another one of those age-old arguments you probably address in your book, I'll have to get it and read it, but, you know, if that's the case, if you are for personal autonomy, then you would expect them to agree with the idea that these things should be things that people choose for themselves.
Matt, let us pick it up, and thanks very much for your call. Alan Wolf, you can hear this kind of attraction and yet real hesitance there to get back in those woods.
Think this caller, Matt, is right to say that some of moments identified with liberal presidents have had a real downside. For me, the biggest examples are the Woodrow Wilson administration, where you had violations of civil liberties and the Palmer raids and a whole lot of things that I don't think anybody should be
proud of. For those who didn't support World War I.
Yeah, and so on. But, that's one of the reasons why, I mean, Woodrow Wilson called himself a progressive. And that's one of the reasons why I warn liberals against the progressive tendency, because the progressive tendency does tend to think that the end justifies the means. Liberalism, as I understand it, in a more generous sense, has a kind of mechanism of self-correction. It looks at mistakes. It's willing to acknowledge failures. It does not believe in a straight road. In fact, it takes very seriously the famous words of the philosopher Immanuel Kant, that out of the crooked timber of humanity, no great thing has ever been made. The road is crooked, and you have to make adjustments. And if you go plow straight forward, as Woodrow Wilson tended to do, there is a danger there.
Byron York, do you see American liberalism as at some point bending back to meet conservatism? I mean, at points, lately, Barack Obama sounds very liberal, but on the campaign trail, you could also hear kind of a third way voice sometimes, some did anyway. Is it possible that there's a meeting of the minds with the sort of grand old deep traditional sense of liberalism having room to meet up with American conservatism or not?
No, actually, I don't see that happening. I think we were talking earlier about some of the practical political implications of this and how it might play out in an Obama presidency. Mm-hmm. That's one thing. There's another thing, if I could address the previous issue, and that is what conservatives worry about as some illiberal tendencies in liberal thought. I want to refer to a review of Alan Wolf's book that appeared in the New Criterion. It referred to a part in the book in which he imagines us to he asked us to imagine a world in which liberal values have disappeared. And the author, who is Canadian, said, well, I took that suggestion and I recognized Canada, where I live, because Christianity has been all but forced from the public square. There are human rights commissions that curtail speech. Mayors have been fined thousands of dollars for refusing to stage gay pride parades in their towns. Things like that. I think that we see that now. This is in Canada, but I think it is an outgrowth of a liberal mindset. We see it in some university towns, for example, and I think that that is a problem. I think that that's some way in which conservatives and liberals will always be divided.
An illiberalism baked in the cake of liberalism, Alan Wolf?
Well, yeah, I actually talk about these things in my book, and in spite of what the reviewer said, maybe the reviewer didn't read the whole thing. I'm a liberal who's critical of some of the tendencies toward enforced political correctness and enforced conformity that Byron York is talking about, and I warn against illiberal tendencies. My book is written as much to persuade liberals to be liberal as to remind them of when they aren't liberal. And there certainly are such moments. I just find it odd to hear conservatives come to the defense of freedom of speech in situations like this one, when conservatives have been so often asked us to rally around the flag or to punish dissent. Maybe conservatives and liberals could come together because both need to learn from each other. I think any kind of triumphalism is dangerous in politics. And as much as I'm a liberal and making the case for liberalism, I don't want liberals to sound triumphant, and I don't want conservatives to do so either.
But it does sound as though you're saying their moment has again come.
Their moment has, and there's a great moment to be proud. It's not a great moment to seek to rout all other political philosophies from the field. It's a moment for liberals to be liberal.
Byron York with the Washington Examiner, author of The Vast Left-Wing Conspiracy. Byron, it's always good to have you. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Tom. Good to be here.
And Alan Wolf, thanks for being with us. Thank you for the new book, The Future of Liberalism. Thanks for joining us.
As always, Tom, thanks for having me.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.